Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. The state of Ohio has received just over $400 million in opioid settlement money, meant to flow to those whose lives were derailed, wrecked, and in thousands of cases, ended by addiction. Across the U.S., payouts to individuals are minuscule compared to what state and local governments are taking in. But some states, like Ohio, forgo individual payments, opting instead to make monetary awards to organizations, mostly through grants. Anari Patari is senior correspondent with KFF Health News, and she's been reporting extensively on the opioid crisis and the billions of dollars in settlement money. Her most recent article is titled, "For Opioid Victims, Payouts Fall Short While Governments Reap Millions." Welcome back to All Sides, Anari.
Glad to be here.
So you begin your most recent story about settlement money focusing on Christopher Julian of Maine, who earlier received his first payment, an individual payment of $324. Now, the county where he lives, in contrast, received $700,000 in opioid money, and millions more are coming in the future. So who decided that Christopher, one person, would get less than $400? What was that money supposed to be for?
Yeah, this is such a complicated sort of how did we end up where we are?
Yeah.
So let me zoom out and talk about, you know, the opioid settlements come from a bunch of different companies, some of which filed bankruptcy. And the ones that filed bankruptcy are Purdue Pharma, Rite Aid, Endo, Mallinckrodt. And those are the only ones that have a mechanism for directly paying people like Christopher Julian or others who are direct victims. All the other companies that are settling, places like CVS, Walgreens, Walmart, are only paying state and local governments directly. There's no mechanism to get money to individuals. So already when you talk about someone like Christopher, the number of companies that can pay him are small. And then he had to apply like everyone else did and submit paperwork showing that they took a particular opioid over how many years and that they suffered harm. Some people don't have those records to begin with. You know, their doctor's offices have shuttered, those pharmacies have closed. So if they manage to get that paperwork, then they're put into a pool of all these people ranked by the amount of harm they suffered. You know, did you lose a loved one? Were you addicted yourself? And there are tiers of payments that they receive. Once they get that giant payment, they have to put out money for the attorney's fees, for the trust that administers all this money. And then what you're left with, what it boils down to, is that 300 something that Christopher Julian got for years of suffering and years of addiction and rehab and all these other costs he and his family went through.
Yeah. And I mean, he lives in a state where money can go to an individual. Here in Ohio, we're having the money is going to, for example, the One Ohio Recovery Foundation controls 55% of the state's opioid settlement funds. So legally, that money can't go to individuals. Do you know why it's set up differently depending on the states?
So it's not exactly set up differently. So in Ohio, there are individuals who have applied for the personal injury suits that are part of the companies that are filing bankruptcy, and they will also be eligible for individual payouts. But there is that larger chunk of money coming from many companies, some of which are not filing bankruptcy, that goes directly to state and local governments. And that is where the One Ohio Recovery Foundation is receiving, you know, the largest portion of that and is saying, hey, we cannot turn around and give that to individuals. Maine, similarly, where Christopher Julian lives, has a council that controls a large part of the money, and they are also giving it out in grants to nonprofits and other organizations. This is sort of a pattern you see in states across the country.
What made states decide, I guess, or whoever decided, I guess, what made them decide that it made more sense to give money to organizations or programs rather than individual people?
I think there's a myriad of factors here. When I've spoken to folks in charge of the money, and some, you know, will say it more bluntly than others, I think there's an issue of logistics. A lot of people say, you know, how do they determine who qualifies? What paperwork do they have to submit? Do the governments have the processes in place to process all that and see who's eligible and who's not and dole it out? I think there's also a lot of people who feel like, well, we can't control what the money goes to if we give it to an individual. You know, will they spend it on something that we, you know, quote unquote, think is correct or right or responsible? And then there's sort of the more public service oriented arguments that if we fund a program or a service to treat addiction or prevent addiction, that might reach more people than if we give money directly to individuals.
Some families across the U.S. say the money isn't being spent in the way it's supposed to be. You mentioned in your article that some counties are diverting the money to law enforcement. Some people are just saying, like, you know, buying a new police car is not what this should be spent on.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of pushback on how this money is being used. And I think part of it is because people feel so personally. The reason this money exists is that individuals died. And if those families are not getting direct compensation that they can decide where it goes, then they're looking at their governments and saying, hey, you got most of this money. You get to decide. Please take into account how we, the victims and their families, feel and want this money to go, what we want it to go towards. So when they see money going to police cars, vests, when they see it going to fill budget holes that don't have to do with addiction, they feel betrayed.
Yeah. So the way Ohio works is, I said 55% of the opioid settlement funds go to the One Ohio Recovery Foundation. And then there's another percentage, I think it's 15%, goes into the state budget. So that's probably that 15% where they're doing whatever they want with it. So not every group in Ohio that wanted money is able to get it, so far at least. You wrote about a group of affected families here who were not happy with how decisions were being made. What specifically did you talk about with Ohio?
Yeah, so I have spoken with a few individuals in Ohio, often moms who have lost their children to overdoses, opioid overdoses, and several of them were really frustrated that there was no direct payment to families. You know, they had to charge their kids' funerals to credit cards because they didn't have enough money, or they had to forego certain types of services or flowers or things they wanted. Some of them are now, you know, grandparents raising their grandkids because the parents have died of overdoses, and they're looking for some support out of the settlement money. But because there wasn't a direct avenue, they decided to kind of come together, partner with some nonprofits, and apply to the One Ohio Recovery Foundation's grant program as this sort of nonprofit unit. They called themselves the Ohio Partnership of Families Impacted by Opioids. And they had this large application where they wrote down sort of, we want, you know, millions of dollars to do X, Y, and Z, which included things like peer support for families, support groups, counseling services, direct aid so that families could buy cribs or school supplies or books, backpacks, things for the kids that they are now raising. But they were not chosen in the first round of grants that the foundation has awarded so far.
Yeah, so the foundation has awarded over $45 million. It's gone to 245 projects throughout Ohio. This was the year 2024. Now, there's more money to come. I think, is this an 18-year process? Did I see that correctly?
Yep, that's correct. So money will continue to flow to state and local governments through the year 2038, which means they will turn around and continue to probably make these grant applications available through that time.
And so the One Ohio Recovery Foundation gets 55% of the money that comes to Ohio each year. The state gets that 15% that I said that can just go into the state budget. And then the other 30% goes to counties, cities, and towns. So smaller than going to the state, but also there's questions about the proportions, because right now we're going to talk about this in more detail in our next segment. But more money is going to bigger cities like Columbus, Cleveland, and Cincinnati than small towns. Have you seen that in your reporting too?
Absolutely. This is a nationwide trend. And some of this is because of the formulas that were used to figure out the distribution. Those formulas tried to take into account the level of harm that places experience. You know, how many overdoses did they have? How many people addicted to opioids? But they also take into account population. And so oftentimes you see these bigger places getting more money when at the same time we know that rural areas, even with lower populations, were very hard hit.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about opioid settlement money and how states are distributing it, including what's being done in Ohio, with Anari Patani, senior correspondent with KFF Health News, and she has been reporting extensively on the opioid crisis and the billions in settlement money. To put this all into context, the overall amount of money available across the U.S., I read in a story somewhere that it said it's basically like double of even NASA's budget. It's a lot of money, right?
That's correct. That's looking at the total that will be paid out through 2038 across all these different settlements. We're looking at over $50 billion coming to state and local governments across the country to, in theory, be put towards addiction prevention, treatment, recovery programs that help address the harms caused by the opioid crisis.
And it's a lot of groups. You mentioned this earlier, Purdue Pharma. There's pharmacies like CVS and Walgreens, some of which have filed for bankruptcy. So there's a lot of different ways this money is coming through. And not all of the companies have started paying, right? Are some of them still like litigating it, maybe?
Yeah, it is a complicated mess, honestly, the legal mores of this. But some of the companies have started paying. And so most governments already have, you know, if you're a smaller government, hundreds of thousands, if you're larger, millions or billions in their bank accounts. Some are spending, some are waiting to spend. But there are companies like Kroger recently, you know, more recently finalized their national lawsuit. So that money is still kind of in process and coming. And then there are still lawyers, attorneys general at different states who are looking at other companies to sue around the opioid crisis. And so there could be new cases, new settlements, and more money to come in future years.
Now, the figure I cited at the beginning of the show, Ohio has received just over $400 million. That's the total when you add up what Ohio received in 2022, 23, and 24. So more will come in 25, 26, and it goes all the way out for 18 years total, right?
That's correct. I believe in the what's left to come for Ohio, there's still more than $1 billion coming in.
And why did they decide to do it year by year instead of just like handing over $1 billion? I mean, I guess I could guess why, but you tell me.
Yeah, so I of course was not in the negotiation rooms between the state attorneys general and the companies, but generally with these large settlements, my understanding from speaking with experts is that companies don't want to give it all up at once. It's easier for them to kind of think about their profit loss statements if they're giving out small amounts over time. And the states were in negotiations with them, and this is where they landed.
Now, there's some states like Pennsylvania, they do not allow people to speak at public meetings. You reported this last June, but and four states have barred the public from attending meetings whenever we're talking about transparency with this money. But by contrast, Ohio does allow the public to attend the meetings and speak and talk about the money. What is your analysis of like involvement of people in talking about where this money goes?
I think it's really interesting that you talk about Ohio and where Ohio is now, where yes, they do allow public to attend meetings, they stream meetings, post videos on YouTube. However, some of the history here is that the One Ohio Recovery Foundation started out not allowing public comment or public attendance, and there was actually a lawsuit filed by a group called Harm Reduction Ohio that tried to promote greater transparency and fight for it. And that is sort of how you saw some of the change come about in Ohio, where now there is the ability for more public involvement. I think you still, if I, you know, when I speak with folks who are on the ground in places like Ohio or Pennsylvania, there's a difference between the ability to participate and being felt like people are truly taking their input and changing the decisions accordingly. So I think there continues to be a lot of tension between folks who say, you know, we're directly impacted, we want our voices to be heard, and the people in charge of the money.
Now, you mentioned that group from Ohio where a bunch of impacted, like moms basically who lost kids to addiction, got together and they created their own nonprofit and they asked for a grant and they didn't receive it. We get a lot of the groups who are getting this money because it's a one-time grant. They're finding it more cost effective, or it makes more sense for them to piggyback on a program that's already up and running. So it seems like some of the grants that are being handed out, especially the bigger ones, are going to organizations that already have existing programs. And have you seen that in places beyond Ohio?
Absolutely. This is sort of a recurring trend and a recurring tension where, again, you have some logistical concerns coming in conflict with what people, you know, the ideal that people wish was accomplished with this money. So people wish that it could go to grassroots organizations and new ideas and innovation. And in theory, some of it's supposed to, and I think some governments are trying to do that. But you also hit up against, though it is a lot of money and though it's coming over 18 years, it's not forever. And so most people in charge of the money are thinking about how do we make sure what we fund is sustainable the next year? If we don't have the same chunk of money to give to this organization, do they have some other source of funding, that means they can sustain the services. And that line of thinking often leads folks to fund programs that already exist to expand their services or to grow them in a different way, because they're worried if otherwise they'll put money into something that will pop up for a year or two and then disappear.
Yeah. And you write that millions have been spent on treatment programs, recovery support, distribution of overdose reversal medications. There's a lot of money going to a lot of these efforts, right?
Absolutely. I think when I talk about this money, there are a lot of reasons to be skeptical. There's a lot of reasons for concern, but it's important to not forget there are reasons to be hopeful too. There's money going to things that are really, you know, evidence-based, that are shown to help people stop using drugs or to enter long-term recovery, to get jobs again, to reunite with their families. So there is money going to a lot of programs and services that help people who've been affected by the crisis.
Yeah. And just going back to Christopher Julian from Maine, who we talked about at the very beginning, you wrote in his story that he made peace with getting less than $400. Did he express to you what his hope is for all of these millions of dollars, how it will be used, if it's not going to go to individual people and any money that will amount to, you know, no life-changing money here for individuals?
Absolutely. I was kind of shocked when I spoke with him, and he was like, you know what, my $300, I'm just going to think of it as a bonus. But what I want to see from my county and my state that has more money is that they really fund programs that help people who are in positions like I was. So when he was looking to get into a rehab, he had to wait 6 months because there were such long waiting lists. So he wants to see the state fund more rehab programs, so there's more beds and availability for when people like him need those services. He wants to see food assistance and rental assistance to people who are new in their recovery and trying to get back on their feet, so that, you know, these programs can really help the individual, even if the individual isn't getting the money in their hand.
That was Inari Patani, senior correspondent with KFF Health News, and her most recent article is titled "For Opioid Victims, Payouts Fall Short While Governments Reap Millions." Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're going to take a closer look at Ohio and who is receiving grants here. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking this hour about opioid addiction and the flow of billions of dollars in settlement money across the U.S. The One Ohio Recovery Foundation controls most of the state's opioid settlement money, but not all. Some goes directly to cities, counties, and even the state. In 2024, the foundation awarded about $45 million in grants statewide in the first round of funding. That went to 245 projects throughout the state, including dozens that provide family support services like childcare and rental assistance. But not everyone is happy about where the money is going. Erin Gottsacker is a reporter for the Ohio Newsroom, where she covers small towns and rural communities across the state. A focus of her work has been the opioid epidemic and how settlement money is being spent in Ohio. Welcome to All Sides, Erin.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me.
Now, before we talk about your ongoing series, can you remind listeners just how the opioid epidemic has impacted Ohio? You know, how does this state compare to the rest of the U.S.? There are certain areas that were hit harder than others.
Yeah, I think Ohio was one of the states hit hardest by the opioid epidemic. I mean, there's whole books written about it, right? I'm thinking of Dreamland, which is set in Portsmouth in southern Ohio. Thousands of people in our state have died every year for the past decade because of opioids. Opioids, I mean, they've not only shattered people's lives, which is terrible, but they've also put a strain on our healthcare systems here. criminal justice systems, our social services. So it's just taken a really big toll in Ohio. There has been some good news recently, mm-hmm. and I think that's important to point out. Mm-hmm. Data from the CDC has showed a 9% decline in unintentional drug overdoses in Ohio in 2023. And that's after a 5% drop the year before. So altogether, that's pretty significant. It's a big reversal from recent years, and I think we can take hope from that.
Yeah, the recent news about opioid deaths being down is really good news, but the addiction issue hasn't necessarily gone away. You conceived of this, and you're the editor of a monthly project that looks at how the settlement money is coming to areas of the state. What made you decide to focus on this topic?
Yeah, well, Ohio is getting a lot of money, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of 18 years. And there's not really a way that the money is being tracked in Ohio. You know, our public entities, our counties, our cities, they're not required to track how they're spending it. And we just thought, as the Ohio newsroom, that it's really important to follow how it's being spent. You know, there was another settlement before this, the tobacco settlement, and that money, it just wasn't really used the way that it was supposed to in the end. And so we thought, wow, we need to follow how the money is being, this opioid settlement money is being spent, to see if it actually is making a difference in the lives of people who've been impacted by opioids.
Can you tell us the ways the money comes to Ohio and then who's responsible for putting it out other ways?
Yeah, it's a little bit confusing because there is so much money and it's coming from several different settlements and going out into the community in different ways. So I'll do the best that I can. But this started in 2017, and that's when Ohio's Attorney General, Mike DeWine, who's now our governor, he was one of the first attorney generals in the country to sue these giant opioid manufacturers and makers for their role in perpetuating the opioid epidemic. And when he did that, other states joined in, local governments decided to sue. So instead of going to court, a lot of these pharmaceutical companies decided to settle. And so these are pharmaceutical companies, we're talking like CVS and Walgreens and Johnson & Johnson and Cardinal Health and McKesson. And so there's not just one big opioid settlement, there's a series of settlements. And so that's where the money is coming from. Like I said, it's hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of 18 years. And so the next question, how is the money being distributed? Well, when Ohio settled, when they decided to form a settlement, they created, it's called the One Ohio Agreement, and that splits the money basically into three pools. 15% just stays with the state, so the state can leverage its, you know, statewide buying power and use it for statewide initiatives. 30% of the funds goes to, you know, specific counties and townships. So Franklin County is getting its own pool of money. Columbus is getting a pool of money. Townships within Franklin money, they're getting smaller pools of money. And then the biggest chunk, so we got the state, local governments, 55% of the funds, that goes to the One Ohio Recovery Foundation. That's a nonprofit organization that was specifically formed to oversee how the settlement money is being spent.
Okay. So, and we invited the executive director, Alicia Nelson, of the One Ohio Recovery Foundation back on the show. She was unable to take part in today's conversation, but we were sent an update that she posted on the foundation's website, along with an op-ed piece she published in the Toledo Blade back in March. In her web post, she spoke about $45 million in grants that were awarded, and her comments read, in part, these critical funds will go directly to fuel life-saving efforts of treatments, providers, first responders, recovery coaches, and community leaders who work tirelessly on the front lines every day. So as One Ohio moves forward, we remain committed to transparency, collaboration, responsibility, and stewardship to ensure that every dollar is used effectively to build a healthier, stronger Ohio. So early on, there were concerns that One Ohio Recovery Foundation wasn't being transparent enough. In the past year or so, are those concerns still there?
Yeah, there were concerns early on about a lack of transparency. In fact, there was a lawsuit where Harm Reduction Ohio sued that group, and that's been resolved. the One Ohio Recovery Foundation does post their meetings online, and I think they're making an effort for sure to be transparent. They've spoken with us for several of the stories that we've done. Mm-hmm. I think right now we're also focused on the fact that all of these local communities and counties and townships, they're also receiving pools of money, and there's no reporting requirements for how they're spending it. And so because there's so much money and it's going to all these places, we're just making as much of an effort as we can to focus on all of the money and finding examples of success and just, you know, holding our local governments accountable for how they're spending it.
And you are covering small towns and communities directly impacted by the opioid crisis. What's your sense of how that money is getting into these smaller areas?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, you have your Franklin counties and Columbuses, and I'm in Cincinnati, so Cincinnati's, and they're really getting a lot of money. But some of our smaller towns, and that's what I cover, is rural communities in Ohio, they're still getting money, but it's, you know, thousands of dollars as opposed to millions. And you just can't do quite as much with that much money. And the way it's distributed, population is heavily, you know, factored in. So that's why Columbus is getting more than, say, Lima. But I think those counties, the smaller counties, the smaller towns, they have to figure out what to do with those smaller funds. And we've seen some interesting examples, like Lima and Allen County. They've pooled their funds so that they have more. They can work together and use that money together to benefit the community. Other small towns, they are using the money to support organizations that are already in existence. So they're not really starting from scratch or creating new jail program like Cleveland is doing. They are supporting things that are already in existence. There's also things you can do, that don't cost as much money. So you can use the funds that you have to make a difference too.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how Ohio's portion of the opioid settlement money is being distributed. With us is Aaron Gottsacker, a reporter for the Ohio Newsroom. One of our reporters, WOSU's George Shilcock, recently reported for your series on Scioto County, and it had the worst overdose and death rate in the state. Now, county officials there rejected the first statewide settlement. Why did that county decide not to join in?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think it's interesting to look at. Scioto County, George's piece is really good, by the way, and I would encourage everyone to read it. But Scioto County, the opioid epidemic really hit that county hard. That's where Portsmouth is located. And this One Ohio settlement, the way it distributes money to localities in the state is really emphasizes population. So like I said earlier, you know, Columbus has a really much bigger population than Scioto County does. Franklin County versus Scioto County is just not comparable. And so Scioto County is getting a much smaller share of funds there, even though the per capita impact of the opioid epidemic, you know, if you look at those numbers, really hit Scioto County hard. So they decided to sit out of that first settlement agreement. They were the only county in the state in the end to say, no, we don't want to come on board to this. And instead, they would like to sue the big three drug distributors independently on their own in hopes of getting a bigger payout. That process is tied up in the court system right now. So, I mean, of the bummer thing is that while other counties are getting payouts because of this one opioid settlement deal, Scioto County is missing out of those funds.
Yeah, but I guess if they would have received the money agreeing to that settlement, they wouldn't be able to sue if they, right? So okay.
Exactly. So they are, I mean, there's definitely hope that they'll get more money than they would if they had joined on board.
Hmm. And the Scioto County Commissioner, Scotty Powell, at the February meeting of the One Ohio Recovery Foundation, stepped down as the Region 9 chair of the board. Is this why? Because of this other lawsuit? Is that why they stepped down?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Well, there was also a story by your colleague, Kendall Crawford, that highlighted Noble County, where Commissioner Alan Fraley talked about how the opioid epidemic has impacted rural eastern Ohio communities. Let's listen.
You couldn't go to a football game. You just couldn't go to church. You couldn't go to an ice cream social without knowing somebody's whole family was hurting.
And then next, Alan commented on the financial need.
We really need any money we get to be as impactful as possible. How can we pull this off?
So what does $100,000 mean to a smaller county like Noble County? How do they decide to spend the money?
Yeah, I mean, again, that is just that's a lot of money, but it's also a fraction of the amount of money coming to Cincinnati and Columbus. But Noble County, they've started spending some of the money. So some of it has gone toward increasing prevention programming at their schools. Some of it has gone toward the court system and improving the court system. And they're also saving some of their money. And I think the thinking is that, well, you know, if we can save it and we can accumulate some funds, then we might be able to do a project that's even more impactful.
It is a big job to determine where the money should go and what kind of assistance. Is there any help to help counties like the smaller counties manage the funds? Do you know how they're doing it?
It is a big job. And I think my understanding, at least, is that all these counties are kind of doing it differently. But there is advice out there. I mean, the experts say, you know, maybe focus on some small purchases like buying fentanyl test strips or creating care packages for Ohioans in recovery. Those are kind of small things you can do to make the most of money. And a lot of another recommendation, I guess, is to kind of create a focus group and figure out within your community, what are the priorities? What do people want? How do they want to see the money? What kind of initiatives are already going on in your county that you can support? And that's really a good, you know, starting off place, at least, to then figure out where the money is going. But I do think there's some confusion in our small towns and rural communities about really how much money they're going to be getting and when it's going to come. And if you don't know that pretty basic information, then I think it makes it harder to plan.
Yeah, and here's Lima Mayor Sharetta Smith talking about how her small Northwest Ohio city manages that.
I don't have a health department or a direct department that can provide the direct services that these dollars were calling for. And so we, rather than looking to build that infrastructure, we look to collaborate with another entity.
So what did Lima end up doing?
Well, Lima ended up, they're working with Allen County, so they are pooling their funds and working together and figuring out ways that they can best support people there together.
Now, many of these payments are one-time dollars. So if the community picks up a project, they have to pick a project that they can sustain afterward, right? It's not, because it's not reoccurring money.
Yeah, I mean, these payments are coming out over the course of 18 years. So the communities are getting the funds for kind of a long period of time. But the way, you know, for example, the One Ohio Recovery Foundation, they're distributing a lot of the money in grants. And those are, you know, they could be one time. And so, you know, I think that's why they're choosing existing organizations to give the money to. And I think that's kind of how a lot of local communities are doing it too, finding an organization that already exists and figuring out how they can support those organizations with the funding that they're getting.
Do they have to have the project already conceived to apply for the grant money? So they have to like know what they want to spend it on. They don't just get it and then they can decide afterward.
Yeah, there's an application for the funding from the One Ohio Foundation. And I know that there's like certain criteria for those grants. You know, they're really looking for evidence-based projects, and there's categories like, I think, you know, prevention and harm reduction. Like there's all these different categories you can apply for funding in. And so the One Ohio Recovery Foundation is looking, for existing projects, but also new ideas that they might have to fund to best spend the money.
Have you heard from places around the state who are unhappy with how the money's being distributed, or maybe they got denied their grant application or don't feel like they got enough?
Yeah, there are people like that. I mean, some people, like, for example, the One Ohio Recovery Foundation, it's distributing grant funds now, but it takes a little while to get that set up, to figure out what the application looks like. And there are people in the state that said, hey, you know, the opioid epidemic this is impacting people right now. And to hang on to that money, we're missing out on an opportunity to help people who really need help now. And I think that's another critique of, you know, our states and local governments also, you know, who might be holding on to this money for a little bit until they can figure out how they're going to spend it. So that's certainly one critique. And then, you know, there are the Scioto counties of the world. Scioto County in Ohio, which they were upset because they thought they deserved more money because of how much the opioid epidemic affected people there.
All right. Well, Erin, I think we'll have to keep updating this project. So people can go to the Ohio Newsroom website. They can hear Ohio Newsroom stories once a month related to this on WOSU as well, right? And all the other public radio stations in Ohio.
Yes, so tune in once a month for our stories.
Yes, and that was Erin Godsacker, a reporter for the Ohio Newsroom. A focus of her work has been the opioid epidemic and how the settlement money is being spent in Ohio. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
Coming up, we're going to talk about a program called Soap and Hope in Pickaway County, an initiative to address homelessness. It was paid for with opioid settlement money. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. There's a strong link between homelessness and substance misuse. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development says it's a double-digit connection, affecting about 16% of the country's homeless population. In Pickaway County, it's a growing problem, one that officials used opioid settlement money to address. It's called the Soap and Hope Mobile Hygiene Unit. And joining us now is Jonna Motter, Executive Director of the Pickaway County Community Action Organization, known as PICA. Welcome to All Sides, Jonna.
Hi, nice to meet you. Thank you for having us.
And also with us is Fallon Kingery, Empowerment Services Director at PICA. Welcome to All Sides, Fallon.
Thank you.
So, Fallon, let's start with you. Can you tell me about the Soap and Hope Mobile Hygiene Unit, which was purchased from one-time grant money that came from Circleville City Council? So tell me what it is, what it looks like.
Okay. So, yeah, it is a 26-foot trailer that we had built from an agency called Comforts of Home in Illinois. It comes equipped with two regular shower stalls and one ADA shower stall. We have a laundry room with two stackable washer and dryer sets, propane tanks for heating the water on the go. We also have a generator for the electric portion of it all. And all we really need to set this trailer up is access to a water source and sewer access for the gray water. So it's just a mobile shower on wheels.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was wondering. Do you drive it around your county then, or does it stay in one spot mostly?
At this point, it's stationary here at PICA, but the goal is to eventually, once we build around this, is to have a truck to pull it from one place to another.
And Jonna, I mentioned that you got it from a one-time grant from Circleville City Council. How much was that grant for?
It was for $85,000, and that was the cost to build the unit.
Okay. So did the grant that you got, it's a one-time grant. So does your organization, PICA, do you have to pay for its upkeep, or are you going to apply for subsequent grants to keep it going?
So we are in the process of looking for grants for the operations. Currently, operating it is 100% out of our pocket or out of donations that we have received for it. The community as a whole does appear to genuinely be interested and appreciate the services of it. So we do have some different groups and agencies around the county that have donated supplies like personal hygiene products, the toiletries and different things that are needed, soaps for laundry, But the water bills, the operating costs for everything are right now, we do not have a grant for that.
Now, Fallon, where did this idea come from? Did you invent the idea of a mobile shower laundry unit, or did you, all the best ideas are stolen. So did you see it somewhere else?
The idea was definitely stolen. I would like to take credit, but I can't. So when we were going out into the homeless camps and things, that was always a huge need and ask, is they wanted a place to take a shower and to do laundry. So we as an agency started doing some research and found that Scioto County Community Action, they had a shower trailer. And they had actually had a smaller one that was in Ross County at Community Action. So we went to Scioto County and Ross County and looked at these trailers and did a little research and found this company in Illinois to help us build it.
And Jonna, what made you decide to apply for opioid settlement money to make this project happen?
I'll let Fallon explain that one. Okay. She was the one that went right for it. And so, yeah, she was part of that process.
All right, go for it, Fallon.
At the time that the mayor of Circleville, he had approached us as a whole, asking us what we thought would be the best use of some funding from this money to help everything going on in the community. And we had already been talking about this. So we pitched the idea to him and he thought it was a great idea. And so we started the process of the application.
Okay. Now, I read that Pickaway County has seen an 8% jump in homelessness just in the past year compared to the rest of the state. Do you have insight into the factors around this increase?
A lot of it is to do with the lack of housing in the community. So Pickaway County is very close to Franklin County and other cities, and there's just a lot of growth, and the community here is just kind of running out of housing, especially the workforce housing.
Can either one of you, can you tell me just about some of the people who have been helped by Soap and Hope Mobile Unit? What have you been hearing when people get to use it?
We hear a lot of great things. It definitely helps a lot for people's dignity and for their self-esteem to be able to go to that job interview or go look at a rental. In the community, we just have a very small homeless shelter for men, and unfortunately, they don't have access to a shower there. So even people from the homeless shelter get to come here and take a shower and use our facilities to wash their laundry. So it's not just people from that are living in camps. We're also seeing people that just don't have running water in their homes. They can't afford it. There's some issue with their wells, whatever the case may be. So they're able to come and use our unit. So we've heard lots of wonderful things. And it's definitely been a huge thing for our community to have this here.
Do people sign up for times, or is it kind of like you just show up and maybe you'll wait in line, maybe you won't? It just depends.
Yeah, you just show up. There's three stalls, and so you just kind of wait in line if there's other. But we try to offer other services while they're here getting their shower. So if that's a referral somewhere, or if they need some food, what other services we have here at PICA, we try to offer while they're waiting.
Can you use it in the winter? Did you have to worry about water freezing or anything like that?
We did. So we were able to use it till it got really cold those several nights in a row. And we did run into some issues. We had some things that needed to be fixed with it. But we are now prepared for next year. We know better what to do and what not to do for next year.
Okay. Yeah. There's always that learning curve. Are you
always
is this a silly question? Are you able to have hot water, or is it like cold showers and cold laundry?
It is all equipped with on-demand hot water tanks. So hot as water as you want.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Well, then that'll help when it's cold, but maybe not freezing.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Right.
Yeah, got it.
Right.
We're talking about an example of one way Ohio's opioid settlement money has been used. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about Soap and Hope Mobile Hygiene Unit. With us is Fallon Kingery, Empowerment Services Director of Pickup, and also Jonna Motter, Executive Director of the Pickaway County Community Action Organization, known as PICA. Can one of you give me a sense of what you know about the opioid crisis in your part of the state, in your county? We can talk about its impact with homelessness, but what's your sense of the opioid crisis there in your county?
We do have there's a strong sense of the opioid crisis here. We have many programs here at PICA that kind of addresses that, but we do see, they say that 16% of our county homeless population is experiencing chronic substance abuse issues along with mental health. So we are seeing a lot of that when we are visiting the different homeless camps and seeing people coming in for assistance.
Are you seeing the opioid settlement money flowing freely to areas of need, or did you feel like you got this grant and it was a pretty smooth process? Do you feel like, you know, or would you reach out for more money and try to apply for another grant?
Yeah, the city of Circleville made the process very doable for us. Mm-hmm. There was a process. We did have to attend a lot of meetings and do an application, but they were very supportive of us and helped us through the process. So we were very happy with the whole process.
Yeah. Do you feel, I guess everyone always wants more money. Do you wish you could have more?
Absolutely.
We could do way more.
Yeah, yes. We could do many other things.
Mm-hmm. Pickaway County has a couple of other programs that were paid for with opioid settlement money. Can you tell about these services? There's a wellness program and there's also some safe and sober activities. Can you talk about those?
So the wellness program is through PICA here, and that it is through the, we have some funding through the Adam H. Board where we provide sober support services and activities, and it helps just promote recovery and community and well-being for those people that were in addiction and are trying to stay sober. So we were able to ask them for some additional funding, and they did award us $5,000 a year to help with our program. So we have to reapply every year, though, but we have been able to obtain this funding for 2 years now. Mm-hmm. And at this point, we've served over 300 clients with this program since we started it in 2020. So it's very successful in Pickaway County.
And Jonna, your website says that you are a Pickaway County poverty fighting agency. Can you tell
Yes.
us about that, your overall mission and how it relates to working with opioid addiction and recovery?
Absolutely. So our overall mission, very simple, helping people, changing lives. And one way we're trying to accomplish that is through the different programming options that we do offer. You know, and with the Soap and Hope, it just fell right into the mission along with the wellness activities and then our rural outreach program going out into the camps and assisting as many homeless as we can with getting referrals into rapid rehousing, attempting to get them, you know, maybe relocated if they're ready for that, or other services to try to really help and assist them along and becoming stable within our community. So we have our average poverty rate is around 12.1% for this county, but we also have almost 18% of children under the age of 18 living in poverty. So we are trying to really help families, children, everyone get back on their feet and make sure that we have services available to assist them in that process of becoming economically stable again.
What more would your organization like to be able to do? I'm sure you have future plans, future hope. If you got all the funding you needed, what would you do next?
We would attempt to change the world. We would make sure that all residents within our county are taken care of, supported, have enough food on their tables, and have a roof over their head every single night. And we would work hard to change everything that we possibly could.
More specifically, what kind of work are you doing in trying to build more housing? You know, you mentioned that the biggest problem is that people are being priced out of the housing that is available. What's being done to build more in your area?
Right now, to my knowledge, it's kind of a standstill. There are some new housing units and stuff going on. PICA is always looking at possible properties to potentially acquire so that we could rent them out to low income families. But it's, you know, it's kind of a process right now with the way that prices are, and then, you know, being able to find the right tenants to go in there to help kind of try to mediate some of the rental things that we see going on right now.
And at this time, PICA does operate over 100 units of low income housing as well as we have transitional living services for homeless veterans and their families. So we're trying to do lots of different things to help the community, as well as finding other partnerships to build more.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today, and I want to wish you luck with getting Soap and Hope out there and running throughout, you know, the next months and hopefully for a long time. So thank you so much. Jonna Motter, Executive Director of the Pickaway County Community Action Organization. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Fallon Kingery, Empowerment Services Director at PICA. Thank you, Fallon.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. This is All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich, and you're listening to 89.7 NPR News.